It's time for ESPN Las Vegas legal insider Justin Watkins with Battleborn Injury Lawyers, only on ESPN Las Vegas and ESPN Reno.
All right, here we go. 4 o'clock hour. Cofield and Company. Justin Watkins in studio. He's talking hats right now with Willie Ramirez. Willie's been very focused today. Enjoyed the show so far. So you walked into the end of what could have been a 12-minute firestorm, but we kind of limited the time on this whole thing. Oh, no. We good? Okay. We were talking about the road trip to Corvallis and Eugene on our Broadcaster Bites podcast.
Yeah.
But not right now. That was last night. We were recapping, because I want to get to that. We were recapping our trip to Logan, Utah. And I know you go to Utah quite often.
Yeah.
So there is a chain. I guess if they open up here, I guess we're not getting this deal. There's a chain up there called Chuck-O-Rama.
Uh-huh.
And there's 9 locations, and there's a couple in Idaho. And one of the guys on the UNLV staff, he loves this place.
Really?
It's your, like, you know, your standard fare buffet. It's not a Vegas buffet. I was telling Willie, I likened it to, you know, when buffets were up and running, like way back in the day, probably 98, like the Sahara was kind of a basic buffet you could go to. It'd be like $8. I mean, like $8 all you can eat. And it's like mac and cheese and burgers. And
yeah, it's like a Golden Corral.
I don't want to badmouth Golden Corral because I've never been there. But the problem was, I, as a child of the Depression, as I'm often called by my family and my girlfriend, which I was not alive in the Depression, but I act like I was, I can make something out of an average buffet. But Caleb was just, he went in. And he really tried the high end stuff, and they just were not ready for a fine palate, and it just turned into a disaster that continued the next morning as he belittled and skewered the man who chose the place. It got
ugly. I mean I agree. Like there's a Chuck-O-Rama in St. George, so it's on the it's on the way to Bryan Head and all the ski resorts that Las Vegas.
We might get them as a client soon. Be careful.
Yeah.
St. George, that could be in our sphere.
If somebody said, let's go to Chuck-O-Rama, I'd be like, no, 100% no.
You would say no. Even with your kids?
100%
no. Get a nice salad.
No.
There was some.
No.
It was Mexican night. You know it's authentic in Utah when it's Mexican night?
Justin, you've been around, obviously, here.
They claim to have the best fried chicken in Utah.
No.
What's your all-time favorite? When you think back to, like Steve says, for him, it's the Sahara.
No. I said that was bottom of the barrel, kind of cheap, basic. That wasn't my favorite.
Okay, what would be your go to back then?
I mean, back in the day when I was a kid, Hush Puppies. That's where we went.
The one on West Charles?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the old building is still there. The new building is there.
Yeah.
That and Sizzler were what I got to go
to. Sizzler Buffet. Standalones, and then in the hotels. I remember when the station casinos came up with the Feast.
Oh yeah.
But you know what was always a good one? When the boys at the Palms came up with theirs, because they had the different, you'd walk in and it literally said the different national ethnicities, and of course they're Middle Eastern, I'm Lebanese, so they had a whole, and it was authentic. Yeah. I really loved it. But then there were some higher ends.
The Rio is the all-timer.
Yeah, the Rio, that's what I was going to say.
The Rio was the Carnival World Buffet.
Yeah. It had a little bit of taste of everything. Yeah. What I remember as being like a young adult was you could go over to Palace Station and they had the seafood, all you can eat. It was like $21.
Yeah.
And it was like legit seafood, man. And so I love seafood, so I would go all in on that.
The comparable one to that was at the Tropicana, the now deceased, the late Tropicana. I believe it was $30. It was a Sunday, but you could get sushi, you could get fish, you could get at one end. When you walked in, it had the entire room, but at the far end against the smaller wall, right? So like if it was a rectangular shape room, was like a regular buffet.
Yeah.
All regular buffet food. Everything else was eccentric. And quail eggs to the seafood area, to the, you know, the barbecue, to the sushi bar. It was fantastic, but we don't have stuff like that anymore.
Did you find some decent spots when you were up in Oregon? I mean, I couldn't help you with Eugene. I can't help you with Eugene.
Well, every time I asked about Eugene, you were like, I've never been there. And then I think your first one was like, I don't know what you said, like the bums and the drug addicts.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I drove around a little bit. That place is interesting. I don't know if Corvallis has some bad areas, but in Eugene, like I hit a local bar, and the guys at the bar, the bartender and a patron, were talking about drug dealers right out front. I drove by some, you know, nothing against trailers, but I mean there's some poverty there, and I don't know what the deal is with drugs in Oregon in general. Now the downtown area of Eugene and around the school, I thought was kind of cool. Okay. We drop in on a lot of these places, and the first time you go, there's only so much research you can do. So I thought in Eugene we found a couple of good places. We do a pro foodie focus scale, you know, PFF. Football does basically everything should be between like a 30 and a 90. I would say Eugene was like right in the 60s for the place we went to. It was solid, not spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, Eugene has a reputation it has for a reason. I mean, it is the founders of like the hippie granola tree-hugging movement that worked its way into, you know, I would say in most of Oregon, there's just a general acceptance of drug use. Corvallis is more a conservative on the western state side of the state, which is mostly liberal in that regard. I mean, if you've ever just do a little research,
I don't mind the granola stuff, and the acceptance of drugs at that point. Then why do there need to be dealers?
Like, dealers? Just do a little research on one of these days about something called the Oregon County Fair.
Okay,
and it's on private land, and it's a whole thing. Everything else that you could ever think of that
wear work boots because you might be stepping on needles.
Everything. It's nuts. It's nuts.
Wow, okay.
It's like Burning Man, but privatized and completely like the police in the state just turn their heads and go, it's the Oregon County Fair, and they just kind of go the other way.
Wow, okay.
But what'd you think? I'm curious.
Corvallis, we only hit one spot. We hit a place called the Angry Beaver.
Yeah.
Caleb Herring's not on here to represent himself, but on the podcast, he talked about it a lot. He thought their wings were as good as any wings he's gotten on the road traveling with UNLV football. I thought their food was solid. I didn't get a great item.
Yeah.
The burgers look good. You know what I'll give you? We had a lady, probably a little younger than me, and her daughter behind us, they walked up at the end of the meal and they're like, hey, you guys should go here and here and here. And then they were like, oh, you have water. So, oh, you're working tonight. But like, we had people who were really friendly in Corvallis with us. So that was cool.
Yeah. I mean, I saw some, you know, back and forth on Twitter. And I will say there are some real sort of annoying people who have draped themselves in the Oregon State name, you know, on Twitter. And they're like, oh, you know, this annoying fan base. But when you go, like, I came half with UNLV people and half with Oregon State people, and we all tailgated together, and they were they're like, hey, do we need to worry, should we not wear our stuff? And I'm like, you will not get
UNLV fans are
afraid? Yeah, I'm like, no. You will not get harassed. Everybody will be friendly. You will be invited to tailgates. They will gladly talk to you about this. And I think most Oregon Staters think we're going to lose this game anyway, so they're just kind of go, and the attendance showed. That was where I was disappointed.
Really?
I thought
it was pretty good. Well, I don't know what they gave the final number. I thought it was like 29,000 out of 35.
Yeah, but we've got to be 34 to 35 every week. That's so when I looked there and I was telling everybody, like, we'll know about what the fan base thinks about this team based on that Nevada loss and what shows up here. And when they showed up, I mean, they cheer and they do a good job. They put on but man, in this year of all years where we're trying to rebuild the pack, we got to show up. We got to be, I think on the season we're at like 97% attendance rate, but we got to be at 97 or above every week.
Big game. I know it's late at night, but it's a big game.
Well, the late at night does hurt because a lot of fans come from Portland.
Okay.
So
great stadium.
Yeah.
I mean, I know they did it in stages. That is a perfect stadium for, you know, this level.
Yep.
I'm not saying, hey, it's not a Power 4 stadium. I think it's a perfect size. I think stadiums need to be smaller in general.
Yep.
So at 35,000, I thought the amenities were good. The concourses were gigantic. This is a stadium they redid, a research stadium that was opened in 1953.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've seen a refurbish job on a stadium that has been done as well as that one.
Well, they blew up the end zones. I mean, so it's not like they redid the current concourse. They leveled it and then built it up. They did each one of those. And the stadium was 46,000 before they did one end. They redid it. They made it smaller because every place had a seat back other than the student section. Right. And they do a great job with student section. Student section goes the whole length of the field for the first 20 rows all the way around for the half of the field. So they kept the students in prime seats. And then when they blew up the other side, same thing. Bigger concourse, more bathrooms, seat backs for every seat. So it lowered it from 46 to 36. But I think overall the experience is just way better because of that.
I got to say on the chainsaw sound.
Yeah.
I actually think they need to lean in on it more.
It's awesome, isn't it?
They have a big chainsaw in the end zone. I think it needs to be a lot bigger.
Me too.
I also think you need a lumberjack on the sideline with a real chainsaw. So now I'm not saying like I'm not going to suggest because there's a safety issue there. Like maybe you have to cage the person. You know, like the tiger at LSU. I'm kidding, not a cage. But I think it would be awesome for Halloween week. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, I would say this.
Put a mask on a guy with a chainsaw. It's scary as hell.
I think the third down chainsaw and fourth down chainsaw is awesome. I really do. Now, in the UNLV game, I think they were like 10 for 15 or 12 for 16 on third downs. It did not work. Every time I heard the chainsaw, I'm like, here we go. They're going to give it up again. But I love the chainsaw. I do agree. And that chainsaw is new, the actual one. Okay. Where it started from is that was the turnover device for Oregon State defense. They get a chainsaw on the end. It's a real chainsaw. That's awesome. The chain's off, but it's running.
That's cool.
So they're running around with that. I mean, they can't hurt anybody, but it's running. And that's the player started that. And then the school took it over. And so they're still building on it. It's been around for maybe 10 years.
End of the game.
Yeah.
I just want your take because I think both sides of this see the end of the game differently.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was it's a weird call if they snap before the call for play is ready, but there clearly isn't a penalty for that, so you can't do a runoff for that. So I don't think that's right that you get a chance to run another play because of that. But at the same time, there clearly is no rule to prevent it, right? Like they played by the rules. I mean,
by the way, if that is the rule and they applied it correctly, then that should be strategy. Like Dan Lanning did that 12 men on the field thing. Yeah. That should be a strategy at the end of the game in panic time.
Yep.
But here's the thing. I don't know if it's really a rule, and I don't know if another set of officials would rule it that way.
Right. Well, I mean,
I think they might call motion. They might call a legal motion and run it off, and you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
We just saw this game as an example. Nope.
Yeah. Well, overall, I wouldn't rely on any of those officials there to be examples of what should be done. I thought it was poorly officiated on both sides of the ball.
Very disorganized.
Yep. As far as like the last play, which I think you're probably asking about, of whether or not it's pass interference on the final play of the game, I don't think it was intentional that they got tangled.
Yeah, they tripped.
They tripped. And so I could see it going either way. Now, you're still responsible for where you're at. Right, and it's not like that player was going for the ball. The defender was not looking back for the ball. He ran into him and tripped him accidentally, but he wasn't making a play on the ball. And because he wasn't making a play on the ball, I could see the call going either way. I mean, I know every Oregon State fan was like, that's a clear pass interference, and most UNLV fans were like, no, that's not. I could see the call going either way. I didn't think we didn't deserve to be there. In the first place, you know, we didn't play a good enough game to win that game. And so the fact that we didn't get that call, I was fine with because I was just going to get my heart ripped out when they didn't get the 2-point conversion anyway or something.
We got 45 seconds here in this block. Do you like your quarterback, McCoy?
I do. I do. I think he made some poor decisions in coverage. But considering, I mean, we all have to remember exactly where Oregon State is in this. They just lost 12 of their best players. Yep. To the transfer portal, their coach, and now on their two deep right now, they have 16 people out on injury. So, like, we just don't have a deep enough roster to sustain that. So I don't really have high expectations as to if we get bowl eligible, I'll call it a victory, and we got to build off of that.
Lost your running back, too.
Yep.
6 foot, 232-pound Damian Martinez purchased off the roster by Miami. So I like McCoy. I will tell you this. Don't just cavalierly throw your hand up when he misses a pass on the sideline, because I did that. I almost had my pinky broken. He throws it freaking hard.
It's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas and ESPN Reno.
History tonight. The first father-son duo to play together in an NBA game. This is all in the family. And what a celebration for the James family. Ronnie's brother and sister, his mom on hand, Savannah, Zuri, and Bryce sitting front row. Outside, dad, hands to his son, gets it back, two-man game. James missed it, rebounded by Edwards.
Ronnie with the missed jump. LeBron with the miss. Yeah, that highlight's not the greatest. I love Ian Eagle, but he kind of forgot to say which one it was. That was one of the lone highlights that I – today I was playing Vast Sound Crew. That was one of the highlights I could find was a pass. Bronny did have a chance at a tip-in on an 83 miss. He didn't get that. So we're asking the dads on the show. Willie hasn't really given his feedback yet. You guys know better than I, and you're not in the position yet of like, hey, my kids are, you know, 18 to 22 years old. They, you know, let's – these magic moments – how do you feel about Bronny getting a chance to play with his dad? First time in basketball history, father-son?
I don't care. Like, I mean, I really feel like, you know, he's manufactured this thing to happen, and we are all pawns in this. I'm just not going to feed into it. Like, it's not real. It is completely fabricated moments. For, you know, people, for maybe a player who doesn't deserve to be there. Maybe he does. But the way in which I don't think he does. I'm just going to say it. I don't think he does.
Yeah, I love that you're pitter-pattering around.
Yeah.
Most people are like, this is silly. I'm not going to say it's silly because it is special.
It's not special.
It is that LeBron had a kid young enough and is a freaking, you know, whatever, conditioning monster, right? Longevity. For his career, that he actually his son is of age that he can actually play with him at 40 freaking years old.
But
I get your point that he probably shouldn't be on the roster or in the NBA.
Right.
Listen, what it's lacking is authenticity, like the Griffies who were there in attendance. That was authentic because we saw Griffey from jump. So I get it. I get when people are saying that. The father-son point of it, where a lot of dads the reason why people want to make it special is because LeBron got to step on the floor and see his kid live out the dream, but at the same time play on the court. For me as a dad, I mean, my proudest moment probably overall three times. One is when Jordan got his pro card in bodybuilding. The second, when he won the junior bodybuilding title in the world in the natural division. And then when he fulfilled the five-year plan and got the keys to the perfect gym. The thing about that is we're just normal people. And guess what? There are proud fathers and sons every single day of kids fulfilling their dream in every aspect of life. That if you're going to go, oh, that's special for those two, then you better be ready to do it for the guy across the street and the guy down the road and your neighbor. But like Justin said, I mean, for me, the word is authenticity. It lacked authenticity because, as I just said in the last, when Caleb was on, okay, now that they've done it good, now get him back to the G League because that's where he belongs.
Maybe, guys, Ian Eagle, who was very enthusiastic on the call, maybe he's the only one who feels it because his son Noah is at that level, very deserving of doing the Olympics. So maybe he has the feeling.
Or maybe
the genuine feeling.
Or maybe he's on the radio and that's the narrative, so you have to be positive and push what you're calling.
Yeah, I mean, and we've had this discussion before, and you know, what's the sort of arc of the discussion goes to, like, nepotism and whether or not it's justified or not. I told you guys, and you guys kind of pushed back pretty hard on it. I think that nepotism is fine to certain extents because there is unique opportunities that fathers and sons or mothers and daughters or fathers and daughters can pass down knowledge of a sport or a craft or an industry or a business or what have you that they happen to be experts in that they can give to their offspring that doesn't necessarily translate to any other person in the world because you don't have that closeness. Now, once you do that, I do believe that person has to perform. I mean, let's talk about Jack Buck and Joe Buck. I think they're great. I think Joe Buck's great. And he acknowledged in his Hall of Fame speech, you know, like, hey, I acknowledge I got a leg up. Yes, you did get a leg up. You got to start further down the track, but he still ran and he still performed. Now, I just don't think at this stage that the leg up that Bronny got should have been this high up and created this opportunity for a moment for LeBron. That's all it was. It was just for him. And I don't need to be a part of that. Like, he doesn't need me to be a part of it. He's doing it for him.
Here's the best way to actually look at this. Forget about the G League. In reality, let's not forget that Bronny had cardiac arrest, came back, finally made his debut, and then declared for the draft. Realistically, should Bronny be a sophomore in college right now? Absolutely.
Yeah.
He could go back to USC and play three more years and get a lot better, because there were other players in college that were a lot better than him last year. So in reality, I mean, there's your answer. Doesn't take away from him being a great kid and whatever, however you want to call it, but the bottom line is, Justin's right. This was for LeBron. This has been a script that has been written. If you ever want to say the NBA is rigged, well, that little portion of the Lakers home opener in the 2024-25 season was 100% scripted.
Yeah, it's WWE.
Oh wow,
it was entertainment.
Okay, let's build on that. Justin Watkins, Battleborn Injury Lawyers. We're here in the Battleborn Broadcast Studio, 766-1400. Call from anywhere in the state of Nevada, phone number, including the office in Reno. WWE. Willie's been going off on this for a couple of days. Final game of the WNBA series. What do you think about the officiating? There's some weird stuff with the commish wearing a shirt with a Statue of Liberty on it.
Themed outfit.
No, I know. It's a joke. Like, I mean, first off, like, yes. If the WNBA wants to establish credibility, they have to do something about their referees. They are terrible. And I don't mean just in that game. I mean, across the regular season, they are terrible. But the amount of reffing that took place, I mean, that game, I watched, you know, it was on against baseball and it was on against football, so I wasn't watching every second of every minute of that game, but I watched the better part of the second half, and they were letting everybody play until the final stretch, and then all of a sudden, New York starts getting all these calls, and the foul on Breonna Stewart was not a foul at all under any circumstances. It was as good of a defensive play as you can make in that moment with all that on the line, as good as you can do it. And the New York Liberty lost that game on that play, and they gave it to them.
And if there was incidental, if there was, let's just say, that we didn't see, well, then you missed a ton of calls earlier in the game where there were no calls, like you said. And they were pointing it out. There were analysts that were there in the arena, very well high respected WNBA reporters that were tweeting, wow, they're letting them play, they're letting them go at it, they were mentioning that and commenting, okay, the refs are letting them go. But not only that, people keep bringing up Breonna Stewart's four and a half to five steps into the lane before Alana Smith quote unquote fouled her. Jonquel Jones walked just before that. So I don't want to say the fix was in, but that's about as close as you're going to get to where, hey, the storyline's written. The commercials are ready to go. Kathy's wearing a New York-themed outfit. I could go up and down the line with Breonna Stewart, Jonquel Jones being former MVPs, Courtney Vandersloot losing her mother earlier in the season. You know, the Sabrina Ionescu finally, you know, the 2020 here in Vegas winning the Pac-12 championship, and then the world shutting down and she didn't get to finish out her deal. So now this is finally her year to win it. So many storylines.
Yeah. I mean, I think overall, though, the league's officiating in the WNBA is incompetent. Like, I felt that way throughout the season. Incompetent. And if you were to just, like, look at some of the calls throughout the year, you can choose Caitlin Clark just because more people have watched her. So I'll just pick her because more people have watched her. And some of the hits and physicality that she took with no calls happening. But it happened to all kinds of players. And then that's the call that you decide to make in that moment, in that game in which you have not done any of those calls. Exactly. It just felt – and to review it and be like, yeah, no. Like, that's the joke of it all. Like, they reviewed it. They're like, yeah, we got it right.
Yeah.
You got to be kidding me. I mean, talk about all ball. her. She had that ball palmed.
They were. I think it was. I think their claim was an arm or something. But nevertheless, it didn't impede anything.
No.
You brought up Caitlin Clark, but how many press conferences I sat in? How many audio clips did we have in audio cuts? Becky Hammon lamenting Asia Wilson getting slammed around all season.
Yep.
Anyone with a top big in this league, they were saying how the calls were horrible and they were, you know, they weren't calling. I mean, Caitlin Clark's one thing, but Christy Sides, how many she was talking about, how many times she talked about Aaliyah Boston not getting calls.
Yep.
I mean, it's everywhere. Former coach Tanisha Wright down in Atlanta, Tina Charles not getting calls. So it you're right.
So, I mean, but my point of all of it is if I was a player, before you cush up the locker rooms, fix the officiating. That's what I need as a WNBA player.
Don't forget, on Sundays, a great spot to watch the NFL is Football Central at Westgate. The day starts at 8 o'clock on ESPN Las Vegas with JVT, Sunday Football Preview Show. John Murray, one of the bosses of the book down there, will appear with JVT in the middle of the show. Westgate, Football Central, every Sunday, great spot to watch the National Football League.
Now back to Justin Watkins with Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas and ESPN Reno.
Battleborn Injury Lawyers here on a Wednesday. 766-1400 is the call from anywhere in the state of Nevada number. Very important in the middle of the show to get to this. I don't know why the middle of the show reference matters, but Willie, I know this is a big week for you and your initiative with mental health. So what do you got going on?
Yeah, every year we do the Baggage Project. Liberty women's basketball coach Billy Hemberger, since he's been over at Spring Valley, this is the eighth year. I had read about this project. A middle school teacher did this where he had the kids write down their baggage, what they're carrying around mentally, but don't put your names on it. They crumpled up the paper when they were done with it, threw it to the front of the room. And he said, that's what you do when you sort of push down your baggage and keep it all bottled up. So he picked it up and he picked up the crumples of paper and he threw them back to the kids and they read their classmates' baggage aloud and it brought the class to tears. So for 6 years, because the first 2 years we did a funner project and then that's when I stumbled onto this. We've done this ever since. And if I tell you that every year there's been at least one kid, if not two, three, it usually brings somebody out to reach out to Coach H and talk to him, and then he guides them toward two today. I'll go back tomorrow for the second part two with the other class, but today after class, two students stuck around, broke down in tears, expressed their feelings. Coach H is going to work with them, get to a counselor, get them some therapy. When he first announced the project, a couple of young boys, which for me is the big part, is if you can reach out to the young men because they're raised to sort of suck it all up and be tough, and you're not supposed to do that. I can't tell you how many have reached out to me and just quietly said thanks because they can't bring themselves to talk about it. But some of the stories you read in these essays, I get them about a week before, are heartbreaking. And the stuff that they're going through at home, a lot of it's the same. Grades, eligibility, making the sport, keeping up with my homework, my social life. And that's great, but you know what? That's life, because as you progress, it'll become work and making money and paying your bills. But some of the horror stories you read that these kids are going through at 15, 16, 17 are terrible. So anyway, that being said, if I could reach out to one kid and it just gets in their head that it's okay to not be okay, then talk, I've done my job.
That's awesome. I've never heard of something like that, but next round, next time, let me know. I'd love to participate in something like that.
Awesome.
We got like 90 seconds here. I wonder in general, and I'm throwing this at you sight unseen, I wonder in general where the justice system is with mental health issues, and especially maybe not for kids, but in the workplace with adults. I mean, it's a tricky situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a shifting paradigm, and I think there's a pendulum that's swinging back and forth in that regard. I think there has been a lot of work in the area of restorative justice and mental health help for people who have done wrongs, whether that's criminally or civilly or, you know, in the workplace. And I think that there is some people who are all in on restorative justice in that form, and I think there's some who say that's not working. And I don't know that we have the empirical data to say whether or not the right approach is or what amount of that approach works. You know, I think just in the state, I'll just bring it to the state. We're seeing a lot of that in the education system where, you know, a sect of the elected leaders are strongly pushing for restorative justice rather than some sort of permanent punishment that happens when kids do wrong. That can keep them in school and hopefully get them to graduate. And there's another group that's saying, hey, restorative justice has another side of the coin, and that is you're putting kids who have not yet received the mental help that they need in the same classrooms and around the same kids who now you're pulling them down. And so I think it's going to be a debate that goes on for the next 10 or 20 years because we don't have the data to say what exactly is working and to what extent.
Coming up next, our eye on sports gambling, but we'll also squeeze in what was going on last week with the Stadium Authority and Steve Hill, an examination of information, and the John Fisher finances and stadium plan. Where is it? Can we just go on someone's word?
It's Cofield and Company's Eye on Sports Gambling, presented by Oasis Bar and Grill, only on ESPN Las Vegas and ESPN Reno.
All right, rolling out here from Battle Born Injury Lawyers in the broadcast center. Willie, Cofield, Justin. So let's get a quick reaction on the latest round of meetings with the Stadium Authority and John Fisher. Apparently was in line to present the finances. And we still don't have the finances. And now it just looks – I just think it looks amazingly convoluted. There's very little transparency. Are we going to get to see what these people voted on and what Fisher is putting forth? Because he's got to cover somewhere between – I'll go low end, $620 million. I mean, some people are saying now the stadium could be $1.5 billion. So now we're looking at over 900 million. No, that's that would be over 1.
Yeah.
Well, 380 to 1.5. We're looking at what is that? 112.
Yeah.
Over $1 billion.
Well, the latest I saw was 350 from the state, the county, 850 from Fisher, and 300 financed. That's okay. What I saw.
This is so crazy.
Number one, to answer your question, I don't think we're never going to see the finances. We're never going to see an audit. We're never going to see any proof of anything. But I will say there is at least one little backstop in all of it. And that is, well, there's two backstops in it. One, any financing must be done through an accredited, A-rated financing agency with credit like that. So if there is financing, good. Secondarily, no bonds get issued until the money is transferred into a holding account. So they have to have the money. Whether the bank provides the check or Fisher provides the check or any combination thereof, not a single bond gets issued until that happens. So I'm frustrated with the lack of transparency. I don't like the appearance of all this being done in backroom deals and that the people who are approving it are the people who are promoting it. I don't like that. I don't like the precedent that sets. And frankly, it was up to the legislature to create the guardrails by which this would play out. The Stadium Authority, in concept, is a public authority that's supposed to be looking out and ensuring that the taxpayer dollars are spent wisely. In reality, that is not what it is at all. The Stadium Authority is filled with members of the team that ensured that the Raiders got the financing they want. Lobbyists and economists and people who testified on behalf of the Raiders getting the deal done. And the holdovers are still in favor of the A stadium. So if you ever think the Stadium Authority is going to hold any of these people accountable, they're not. They're cheerleaders. That's just to put it frankly, they're cheerleaders for the stadium to happen. So thankfully, the legislature did put these guardrails on about the money has to be there before we ever do anything. Now, you know, I'm already seeing some slippage on these timelines for the state. First off, we're already a year behind where they told us in the legislature this was going to happen. We already have a completely different ballpark than what they said it was going to be. But frankly, I think it got better. So I'm not even complaining about that. I think the ballpark rendering is great. But they said we'll break ground in April. But if we don't break ground in April, we still there's like 4 or 5 months of slippage in there that we could still get. We could still delay 4 or 5 months and have it ready for opening day in 2028. Like, I already see the door being cracked open to this being a 2029 thing or later. I don't know. But time will tell. There's a meeting October 31st where some of the agreements will be presented to the stadium authority. The agreements, the lease agreements and land use agreements will be public. So we'll get to see that. The vote will be in December. So we'll be able to see what the terms are. They have deadlines for getting these agreements done. They got to start getting some of these agreements in place. They can't break ground without these agreements. And if their target is April, like you asked me off air, what are the chances that they break ground in March of 2025? And I'm saying zero. Zero. I mean, April, you know, I don't know, some small percentage. By the talk that they're already putting in the public of preparing us for delays, I'd say expect delays.
A good exchange, and a really good person to follow on this is Al Snell at LV Sports Biz. He had a video with Steve Hill talking. Las Vegas Stadium Board Chairman Steve Hill says public does not need to see Fisher documents validating Fisher's financial ability to build a $1.5 billion stadium on the Strip. Quote, it's confidential. Elise Davin Stewart, if I mispronounce her name, I apologize, but she responded or retweeted it saying $380 million of taxpayer money is going into what will be the smallest MLB stadium ever, and the A's still owe $1.2 billion. Bonds, tax credits, and the TIF district are in the mix, taking funds from public services, and they're getting a 30-year tax break worth $55 million. So how exactly are you covering your share, bro? When public money is involved, transparency isn't optional.
Generally, I agree. But again, none of our dollars get spent without them depositing the money into a holding account. So I think that alleviates those concerns. If we had to issue the bonds today on a promise of the future, then I agree. Like, public needs to see that. Like, but the fact of the matter is the money goes into this account. Does it really matter how they got it there? I don't. Does it matter that the bank relied on these bank statements? We're not the bank. If they lend it to them, they lend it to them. If he puts the cash in there, he puts the cash in there.
Right.
As long as that holding account isn't saying, okay, we know you're good for it, which they can't do. The money has to be in there. But if something happened along those lines where they said, oh, we reviewed Fisher's records, we know he's good for it, go ahead and issue the bonds, then I think the public outcry needs to go through the roof. Then I think there needs to be legal action at that point because it's in violation of the statutes. So I don't think that's going to happen only because Steve Hill followed it up by saying these very things, which is the money's got to be in there before we do anything.
So we got a big college football game coming up, and there's a really good Thursday-Friday slate. But obviously here in town, 7:30 start, Boise taking on UNLV. The number is actually down to Boise -3 straight up. Willie, I know you wanted to address an angle of attendance and why it's important even well beyond this game.
Well, because the big question has been in terms of Barry Odom and how long he's going to stick around, right? And this has always been a winning town. Produce a winner and we'll show up. UNLV basketball is a prime example of that. We've talked about this a number of times when it came to Julian Strother and when he went to Gonzaga. And one of the determining factors wasn't just that Gonzaga was a basketball predominant school and it was a non-football school, but it was the fan base and the support. But not only that, but the ugliness in the fans and how they turn on UNLV basketball so quick. So in regard to football, we've seen the hatred that the local fan base has had, and they produce a winner, will show up. You know, bring somebody in that could bring winning back to UNLV. Well, Barry Odom has done that. So the problem is you have this 60,000-seat stadium, which doesn't seat 60,000 for UNLV football. They push some of the bleachers back. They usually try to stack the bottom. But if you had the demand for the tickets, at some point, if you're capping out around 20,000, why would he stick around if he's going to get offered a lucrative contract where they have a stadium that's going to put 40, 50,000 people in the seats. You got 2.2 million people here, and you have now a second straight year of success in college football. They're playing a decent schedule. They've been nationally ranked, and they're legitimately this Friday, they're vying for a college football playoff spot. Conceivably, tonight Liberty's playing. That's a game all UNLV fans should be paying attention to if you want UNLV to vie for a college football playoff spot. So, you know what? It's not just on Barry Odom. It's on the fans to get out and support UNLV football.
Justin, there's also a metrics discussion to be had where all these schools that are outside what would be a Big 60 are being looked at in terms of their numbers, and crowd size is part of it.
I mean, I think it's part of it. I think TV viewership, crowd size, what the environment feels like when you go to the game. Nobody likes to go to a game with an empty stadium. But I would say this, as a lifelong resident but not a UNLV grad, I think some of those expectations and the reputation, the expectations are somewhat unrealistic and the reputation is somewhat unfounded. Because back in the 80s and the 70s, when UNLV basketball was getting attendance, it wasn't getting attendance from UNLV grads. There wasn't enough of them. You got to remember, UNLV started in 1957. That's 100 years after Oregon State started. We've got generations, and Oregon State's not a big school, but we got generations of alumni that continue to build on each other. And the ones who donate and the ones who spend the most on that stuff are the oldest ones, not the youngest ones. The oldest ones are who donate and support the program because now they're retired and their kids are gone and it's what they want to do. They have some excess money. UNLV doesn't have that generation there yet to support it financially. You know, you talked about our football stadium being upgraded, $400 million. That was all privately funded by small donors like myself.
Yeah,
at Oregon State, right? UNLV doesn't have that donor base. And yes, they supported a winner in the 80s and 90s, but that's not because there was UNLV alumni. It's because there's nothing else going on in this town sports-wise other than boxing and UNLV basketball. So non-alum went to those games because it was something to go to. Well, when they start losing and we start getting professional sports, non-alum like myself, I will, because I'm a big sports fan. I will go to a UNLV game.
There is a competition for entertainment dollar. And to Willie's point on the front end, if you don't win, it's hard to draw people. And yeah, I mean, reality might be for UNLV football, they might have to win 4 years in a row. But guess what? Barry Odom could look at it and go, you know what? I'm doing a good job. I'm doing all I can. I don't want to be a cheerleader.
Totally.
Have to build the crowd.
All due respect to your point, Justin. You have a law firm. You're a lawyer, and you support a lot of local stuff, including the sports and this show and Lotus. And you love local sports.
Yeah.
But you're also comfortable, right, and able to do so. The people that the sports fans that can't afford the Raiders prices or can't afford Golden Knights tickets, Aces are somewhat affordable, but they've jacked their prices up. Here's an ample opportunity to go support a successful program that is putting a good product on the field. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, and I'm not disagreeing with that. 100%. They should, you know, like the community should rally around this coach and this team. And I guess the argument I would make for Barry Odom sticking around despite something like this is if you look at all the great stories of men and women who are revered at an institution and in a community, they all had this, right? Coach K had to build Duke up. Mark Few had to build Gonzaga up. There's examples that are escaping me, but there are a lot of examples where, you know, I'll go even a smaller sport. You go to an Oregon State baseball game, there'll be 6,000 fans there. They've had to renovate a stadium all because Pat Casey coached that team for 13 years before they got to their first College World Series. So, you know, the coaches that do stick it out and do invest in the community, it does happen. But, you know, to be fair to the fans, two good seasons in 30 years is kind of a tough pill to swallow to expect it to happen overnight. You might be right. It might be four winning seasons, or they make the college football playoff. It might happen. Like, that might just turn the tide.
Yep, that could be the impetus. Less than 30 seconds left. You said you were on a heater right now with college football. Give me a play.
I like Penn State on Wisconsin. I'm against Alabama all throughout. That's worked for me so far. So I think Wisconsin's really no good. Give me the Aggies. Minus one on the road against Wyoming. I like that play too. Utah State. So those are
guys all over it.
Real quick, UNLV, Boise State. What are you doing?
Boise State.
All right.
I mean, I hope UNLV wins, but I bet I'm laying the three.
Thanks to Justin. Appreciate it. This part of the program is brought to you by our friends at Oasis Bar and Grill, Decatur, south of Trop. Great specials every single day for dinner. Of course, 24/7 breakfast. And you can go hang out on Monday nights with Johnny and the Monday Night Maniacs.